John, wouldn't you say that what we're dependent on, we call reality, and what we don't like, we consider an intrusion in our life? Consequently, I feel that what's happening is that we're continually being intruded upon.
That would make us very unhappy.
Or we surrender to it and call it culture.
Call it culture.
Or whatever.
Give me an example. What would be an intrusion on your life, for instance, that you would call culture?
Well, this weekend I was on the beach.
Yes.
And on the beach these days are transistor radios.
Yes.
Blaring out rock and roll.
Yes.
All over.
Yes. And you didn't enjoy it?
Not particularly. I adjusted to it.
How?
By saying that I thought of the sun and the sea as a lesser evil.
Well, you know how I adjusted to that problem of the radio in the environment. Very much as the primitive people adjusted to the animals which frightened them, and which probably, as you say, were intrusions. They drew pictures of them on their caves. And so I simply made a piece using radios. Now, whenever I hear radios, even a single one, not just 12 at a time, as you must have heard on the beach, at least, I think, well, they're just playing my piece.
You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Executive Director at the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is artist Richard Kraft, who some of you will remember from an earlier All Things Cage program on the subject of the first complete edition of Cage's diary, How to Improve the World, You Will Only Make Matters Worse, which he edited, with his wife, Lisa Pearson, publisher of Siglio Press here in the Hudson Valley, which aired on March 27th, 2021. I enjoy Richard very much, and this week he's agreed to talk with me about the John Cage, Morton Feldman radio happenings, five programs that were aired on New York City's WBAI between July 1966 and January 1967. These radio happenings were published in 2015 in a beautiful bilingual edition, English and German, collaboratively produced by Gisela Gronemeyer of Musiktexte in Cologne and Brian Brandt of Mode Records, now here in the Hudson Valley, an edition that includes a DVD containing digitally remastered recordings of all five programs. Richard loves these conversations between Cage and Feldman as much as I do, sharing as they do something of the day-to-day lives and thoughts of two of our favorite people who were close friends. We began tonight's program with a bit from the very start of Radio Happening Number 1, which took place on July 9, 1962, and we'll close tonight's program continuing on from there. So welcome to All Things Cage, Richard. It's great to have you back again.
It's great to be here, Laura. Thank you for having me.
It's just so great to have a portion of the afternoon in which you talk with someone you really like about a book, recordings, whatever you want to call the radio happenings from your point of view, who loves them just as much as I do.
I've loved them for a long time. I was trying to think before we spoke of when I first encountered them. And it must have been very early in my relationship with John Cage, and I'll call it a relationship because it's been a long one and is ongoing. And I think a friend of mine told me about them. I listened to them while I was working in the studio. And there's a story right at the beginning of the first happening where Morton Feldman is, as you know, complaining about the radios at the beach. And he finds it an intrusion on his experience at the beach. And Cage responds by saying, well, my reaction to this was to make a piece using 12 radios, I think. And now when I hear these radios on the street, I think they're playing my piece. And how can you not be taken by something that begins like that?
That's exactly how I feel. I love the overall, across the five happenings, the relationship between these two people, which is both incredibly fun and close. They obviously enjoy each other and like each other very much, but I can't help but feel like Morty is the one who brings forward things that trouble him. And John is the one who is like the sage big brother who gives Morty different ways to think about things.
Yes, yes. And so I wanted to ask you, is that how Morton Feldman was in general? Or was he bringing a persona to these conversations?
It's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, I wasn't super close to Morty, although I knew him a bit through Cage. I think he was a person who grappled with things more than Cage did. And he brought that forward to Cage because Cage was so, sage-like. He took very seriously things that he didn't let Morty get away with things. Remember when Morty, even what you just said about the intrusion business, the Cage says, well, really, we could also say that we're the intruders. Maybe the beach belongs to the transistor radios, and maybe we could turn that on its side and think about it the other way. And so I think that in a way, it may have been the nature of their relationship because Morty could trust that Cage would take him seriously and give him, maybe he wouldn't adopt them, but give him other ways of thinking about what he was thinking about. Maybe. I don't know. Who knows? They were very close.
Right, right. Well, Cage often in their conversations comes up with solutions, doesn't he? I mean, they're in the, I think it's the fourth conversation, Feldman brings up the protests against the Vietnam War. And actually, for me, this is a very interesting interchange, in part because I think it says a lot about Cage. So Cage's response is to say, well, I don't think protesting does much other than make the protester feel like they're doing something. And Feldman really struggles to sort of take this in. And then Cage goes on to say, well, really what we need to do is to make the world a better place and use the resources we have in much better ways so that wars such as this just become untenable and unnecessary.
And that they don't happen. That was his ideal, was that they didn't need to happen because everybody would have what they need and they didn't need to fight over water or power or whatever it is that people fight over.
Yeah.
It would all be about love. It would all be about love.
Right, right. Which raises another question actually, because Cage seems to have a great faith, really, that if there's enough, you know, if there are enough resources, that people won't fight over them. Yet, I wonder, you know, I think about our time now and the enormous wealth that's being accumulated by very few people. And they don't seem inclined to be happy with and say, we've got enough, you know, they seem to be intent on building it. So I'm curious how you think about this aspect of Cage's thinking.
Yeah, for me, I think Cage's thinking on these topics, on such topics, really comes out of his trust in relationship with appreciation for Marshall McLuhan and Buckminster Fuller. Who, you know, McLuhan talked about the shift in culture, technologically the shift, and how that affected things like distribution or dissemination, if you will. Distribution is probably not the right word. And Fuller believed absolutely in the goodness of technology as a means of distribution, as a means of sharing. So I think that Cage took his lead from both of those people, for right or wrong, for, you know what I mean? I think those ideas, he adopted those ideas from people. He believed when he, late in life, became interested in the writings and the work in nanotechnology, it was the same thing. He didn't really know anything about nanotechnology, but in theory, he believed that that would make things faster, cheaper, easier for people, and there would be less to fight about. There would be less scarcity, if you will. Wow. Do I think he was right? I don't know.
Yeah.
It was nice to be around that kind of optimism, though. You know, that's a very can-do way of holding problems in the world, isn't it?
Yes, and I think also a very American way of facing problems. And I think American in the way that Cage sort of defined it. His notion that real American ingenuity could create a society in which people don't have to have jobs, for instance, you know,
I love that, actually. I have that conversation with people. Not all the time, but, you know, with enough frequency that I can tell you 10 of them over the last year, where I've made some comment to someone and realize it comes out of this idea of being useful and not worrying about jobs and not worrying about, you know, to put your energy into doing things that you enjoy doing and that are contributory in some way. And I'm sure that comes out of that spirit that Cage lived by. I remember, for example, this is just a little thing, but I was remembering this just the other day because I drove through New Jersey to come back to New York. And in New Jersey, they don't have the pumps at the gas station. You can't pump your own gas.
Yeah.
And I remember I had this memory of driving in Oregon, in the state of Oregon, many years ago. My mother was with me, so this had to be in the 80s. And we were driving through Oregon, having a wonderful trip together, and we stopped for gas. And I made the comment to the young woman who was pumping my gas. I said, why does Oregon, you know, have this law? This seems crazy. And she said, I don't think it's crazy. I mean, it's my job. And I said, yes, but don't you think you should be doing something more worthwhile than pumping my gas? And it really irritated her. Yes, she was deeply offended, you know. But I thought, gosh, here's this human being with all these faculties and all these capabilities. She was young, 20, 22. And I just thought, what a waste, you know, and I'm sure that read to her, you know, that I was disdainful of her choice of occupation, which is really stupid on my part. But it comes out of, you know, that idea that you have to make the world safe for unemployment. I mean, what is employment anyway? You know, it can't be just, and this would be Cage, you know, it can't just be to get a paycheck. What a waste of a human being.
Right.
That's how I feel anyway.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it recently, actually, because you've probably noticed this as well. In New York, they've finally removed the toll booths on the freeway and various other roads for these automatic things. And I have been thinking about the people who staffed those toll booths and whether or not they've been set up by the state to do other things or whether they've just been laid off.
It is a question, you know. I guarantee you that if you had that conversation in a group of 10 people, 8 of them would say, and those were good jobs.
Right.
You know, because they paid a state wage, their benefits attached to that, it's regular, it's safe, you know, all those things. And in point of fact, you just wondered, really, is this a good use of a human being to stand in a little booth for 8 hours collecting money from people? You know, it makes me cringe, the idea of spending one's life like that, your lifeblood in that kind of work. But such has been the pattern, not the pattern, but the fabric of capitalist societies, of first world countries, you know, that you have these people I don't want to say on the bottom, it's so ridiculous to even think like that, but you have, you know, different strata of a workforce that keeps up the society going. And some of them get to use their brains far more than the others. I think that's the crime. It's not the paycheck. It's not the amount of money. Because if everything were distributed properly and fairly, it wouldn't matter. Money doesn't really matter, really. Cage believed that people should only work if they wanted to work. It shouldn't be tied to livelihood.
Right. Do you think he would be optimistic now? Would he have retained his optimism?
I don't know. He used to say, he told me once that a lack of optimism was a sign of fatigue. That when you were disgruntled with things, that was fatigue. And as you age, as we all well know, the more you age, the less energy you have. You become more easily fatigued. So I think he might be like the rest of us, you know, who loses some of his optimism as he gets, you know, his back bows or his legs get tired, or I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
He didn't live all that long. He was only 79 years old, which by today's statistically speaking, I think that's fairly young for a man to die, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. I would say so.
Yeah. You know, these radio happenings were really buried for a long time. Nobody really knew about them. And they surfaced for us, meaning John and I, during the time that he was doing his Harvard lectures. And so I had a lot of free time on my hands because he spent a lot of time trying to figure out what he was going to do for these Harvard lectures. So he was brooding, he was pacing, he was sighing, he was cleaning the kitchen cupboards. You know what I mean? He couldn't quite get a grip on what he wanted to do. And my work depended entirely on his work. And so I was making things up to do in the house. And I came upon a box of cassette tapes. So I transcribed the radio happenings, which
I saw that in
yes,
the book.
Exactly. Yeah. I just spent, I don't know, a week transcribing these radio happenings and told him with great excitement that I was doing this. And he was sighing and said, oh, isn't that nice? You know, and we put them away. And it wasn't until Gisela Gronemeyer from Musiktexte, who published the complete Radio Happenings, the book that you now have, which is bilingual in her native language, German, and Cage's and Morty's native language of English. And it wasn't until she showed up for lunch one day and she was scavenging around the house, looking for something that could be a publishing project. And sure enough, she glommed onto this little stack of paper that I had just finished. And she said, what about this, to John? Don't you think this? And John sort of waved his hand and said, oh yes, that would be fine. And off she went with them. But it took a long time before she actually—
Yeah, I mean, so because this book came out just a few years ago.
It was like 18, 19, right? 15.
2015, no. 15.
Isn't that amazing? Gosh, 6 years ago.
It took her a long time. So Laura, I'm curious, whose idea was the radio happenings?
That's a good question. I have no idea. You know, it sounds like something that Cage might have initiated with WBAI. He loved talking, and he loved talking with Morty more than anybody, I think.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I think I even told you, or maybe I even said this in an earlier program, but he and Morty, sort of after the formation of the New York Composers, he was disgruntled at the formation of that group of people, and he and Cage fell apart a bit and never really got back. And their compositional strategy, it was with James Pritchett, now I remember, their compositional strategies and processes were very different, Cage and Morty, but nonetheless, extremely cross-influential on each other. But they weren't really close. Like when I was around, they weren't particularly close. However, when Morty ended up in the hospital with cancer and was dying, it was clear, he was on the telephone. He called Cage almost every day. And they would talk for hours. They would just, Morty in his hospital bed, probably on dialysis or something. I think it was kidney maybe or liver. I don't remember. But he and John would just talk for hours. It was very moving. Yeah. And they were just talking about life. You know, they were just, it wasn't anything ground, you know, breaking. It was just, they were clearly friends and Morty wanted to talk to John.
So. Yeah, there's a lovely moment in, I forget which conversation it's in, where Cage says, well, we could be talking about anything really, and it would still be about music. And I thought that was really a lovely.
It's lovely. Moment. Exactly. Yeah. I think that John was, I don't know, for us mere mortals, one thinks about talking at length with a friend who's dying in the hospital as being potentially draining, potentially enervating, you know, potentially you'd have to lie down for a while afterwards. And right. I don't remember that with John at all. I think he was enlivened by talking to his friend, even though his friend wasn't going to be with us very much longer.
Right. Well, there's a lot of laughter in the happenings, and that's a really nice thing. They amuse each other, but they also amuse themselves at moments. You know, they'll say something and make themselves laugh. And in that way, again, this sort of insight into both men that perhaps one doesn't get in other places. There's also a section where Cage is talking about a Duchamp, actually. I made a note because I wanted to ask you about it. Sorry, Laurie.
About Duchamp?
Yes.
I'm trying to think if I was...
Here it is. So Cage is talking about actually the deaths of friends.
That's right. And he's got three that died in a row.
Yes. And then he moves on to talking about Duchamp. And so it really feels as if, you know, the way one's mind works in conversation is it makes leaps and jumps from one thing to another. And,
right.
You know, normally with somebody like Cage or anybody with whom one doesn't have that kind of access, you don't get to see the mind at work in that kind of way. And I really enjoy that about both of them in these conversations.
Yeah. No, I know. Do you remember a story? I've always wanted to go back and I haven't encountered it yet, but I'm not quite through of rereading it. Do you remember a story in here about Morty having I think it's later, but I'm going to ask it anyway, where Morty is having a hard time composing. He's worried, he's thinking of seeing a psychiatrist. Do you remember this in the happenings? Maybe it's not there.
Not the psychiatrist. That he does talk about, one gets the sense of his grappling with various pieces that he's working on and working them out. But I don't recall him mentioning.
I think it was later. And it's just a wonderful story, maybe appropriate to tell here, where John told me this story that he had bumped into Morty on the street and Morty looked terrible. And he was, you know, he said, what? And this was in the dead of summer, you know, and the streets were packed with people. And he said, what's wrong? How can I help you? And Morty said to him, I can't compose anymore. I can't think. I think I'm leaving. I don't know what's wrong. I'm thinking about seeing a psychiatrist. And they parted. And John was quite worried about Morty after this conversation. And weeks went by. And he bumped into Morty somewhere else. And Morty looked wonderful. And John said to him, you know, what did you do? You look fantastic. Is everything better? And Morty looked at him quizzically and he said, oh, I got an air conditioner.
Right. Well, that can make a big difference in New York in the middle of summer.
In the summer, exactly. But that it struck me that was very, even that story was sort of echoed for me in the radio happenings when those finally came, you know, in front of all of us and we could all read them and listen to them. That it would be like Morty to have something, some experience and internalize it and worry it, chew on it like a bone. Whereas right. Cage wouldn't, they had very different personalities that way. And so the book is very much Morty chewing on things. And John sort of lifting it out of the debris.
Yes.
I think it's very funny.
It's interesting that you say that the two instances in that story that they bumped into each other, which happens in a city like New York. But Cage in, and again, I forget exactly which conversation it is, there's a little interchange about the telephone and the telephone book. And as is the case in Diary, Cage is adamant that one should have a phone, one should be in the telephone book, and one should answer the phone. And I think he even says in this conversation that there should be an 11th commandment, that thou shalt answer the phone.
Absolutely. Absolutely, he felt that way. And he was driven crazy by the phone because he was in the phone book. So he was interrupted constantly. And I remember it might have been me or Andy or somebody in the house made some comment about this over lunch together and suggested that John get an answering machine. And John was horrified at this thought because he said, oh, no, then I would have to answer people. That the onus would be on him to call people back. And he didn't want that.
There's a whole section in Diary about the answering machine.
Exactly, actually. Exactly. It was a very big deal for him.
So why? It really sounds as if he felt it was a responsibility to answer the phone. You know, Feldman is doesn't want to be disturbed. He wants to keep composing or keep thinking. And you know, Cage is you answer the phone.
Yeah.
So why? What was that about?
If you think about it, Richard, is not so odd. It's consistent with him. Because he believed, for example, here's a really good example. I remember one of my jobs was to sort the mail. So when the mail came in each day, I would sort it into three or four piles. And one pile would be bills, you know, money things, bank statement, whatever. Another pile would be things that we could just file away, like a program or something that someone had sent for him to just see. And another pile would be people asking for things, telling him about their music and wanting advice, complaining about their job, you know, their teaching job or something like that, and asking John to respond and be with them like he is with Morty, you know, to pay attention to their troubles. And John would complain about the bulk of this. And I remember one day kind of losing my patience with him about this. And I said, well, look, you don't teach. You don't have any responsibility that way. Why can't you just think of this as how you teach? So here's how you're going to give back. And he loved this. And from that day forward, he never complained when people wanted something from him.
How big was that pile of lessons usually?
It would be, you know, four or five things a day.
Well, that's a lot.
It was a lot, but it was like a moral thing that if he was going to be in the phone book and answer his phone and be this person that he said he was or behaved like, then he couldn't close that part off. He couldn't say, I'm not answering that mail. I'm not going to give them advice, you know, no matter how he felt about it. Yeah. He sat down and he wrote answers to people. Some of those show up in the selected letters. You see him writing to someone that there's no footnote for because we have no idea who they are. I remember a very sweet instance of that when I was doing the selected letters. There was this letter to, I'm forgetting his last name, and I couldn't find this person. And John wrote this person this very beautiful letter about his age and about how he wasn't composing as much music as he used to, but he was writing a lot of texts. He was doing a lot of speaking things. And I thought, who is this person that he's giving all of this to, which is so beautiful. And it turned out to be an 11-year-old student in a middle school in Texas who had an assignment to, all the whole class had an assignment to write to some famous creative person and ask him a question. And his question, I found the original letter from this kid, said, what's your life like? What do you do? How do you come up with ideas for your music? This very
How on earth did this 11-year-old in Texas know to write to John Cage?
I don't know, but he was in the phone book. Right. You know, he could find he could find that address and he could write to this person. And here's this person writing him back and taking him. You would never know from the letter, other than maybe the vocabulary of the letter. Now that I think about it, it was not, you would never know that it was a response to an 11-year-old. He treated the 11-year-old like an intelligent human being who was asking him reasonable questions, questions that we all might want to ask. You might not, or I might not ask him because we might think they seem too simple.
Right. Well, it sounded like a good question to me.
Well, you and I forget the kid's name. I feel bad now because it's in the selected letters. And I struggled with this one because I couldn't footnote it. I just didn't know who this person was. But it just turned out to be a kid who was, you know, asking questions. And John gave him, he treated him with as much honor as anybody in life, famous, not famous, old, young, male, female, black, white. You know what I mean? It didn't have anything to do with anything. It was just someone, another human being who was writing to him. And by the way, I found this out because when I went back to Northwestern, where the original letter would have been housed, and pulled up that letter, not just Cage's reply, it starts, my name is blah, 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 and I'm an 11-year-old student at, and I did do a footnote finally, but he was at a school in Texas, but it sounded like a school in Connecticut. It shared a name with Middletown or something like that, but it was in Texas. But he was like that, you know. That isn't to say though, Richard, that again, you know, I always, I have a caveat whenever I speak for Cage in a way that I only knew him at the end of his life. I was only around him for the last, it was really six and a half years. So the qualities of him were colored by relative fame, financial comfort. He was never rich, but he was okay. He, you know, he could have the things that he wanted and he could help Merce and he could help others. But he was also running out of energy. So anyway, in the context of that, that's really my view. Jasper right. Johns would correct me every now and then when I would say something and he was around. He'd say, well, Laura, you didn't know John when he was, you know. I mean, fair enough, you know.
How aware was Cage of money, of sort of managing money and spending money?
He was a child of the Depression. So, you know, money for him was, we were not a spendthrift. You didn't buy a lot of things for yourself. He spent more money on flowers than anything. Maybe flowers and food, And then later on, Chinese herbs for his health. That was where the money went. It wasn't, you know, and taxis, because he stopped taking public transportation as he got older because he was limping. So, but he, there's a very funny line where he, when he started doing visual art, which happened in the last decade of his life, which for musicians was, it was like a gold mine because you could sell an artwork and get a big fat check from someone, you know, which didn't happen in music. It just didn't happen. Or the amount of work equal to the amount of money was so disparate in the art world versus the music world. And he was talking to Tini Duchamp. I've never forgotten this because he burst out laughing after the phone call because I didn't hear Tini. I just heard him. And he said whatever, what he said to Tini, and then Tini said something back. And what he said was, Tini, I'm selling artwork. I'm rich. And Tini said, oh, nonsense. You're not rich. You're merely comfortable. And that was true. He wasn't rich at all. He gave away, this is a fact, he gave away more money in like 1989 to other people than he had ever earned in a year before. Isn't that nice?
Who were the beneficiaries?
Anybody who needed it. Anybody who asked him that he was close to. He bought people ice cream machines because he fell in love with his. So five different people got these beautiful electric ice cream machines. He was, you know, he was kind. He was a kind person that way. And, you know, any energy that he didn't spend on himself, meaning composing and touring and performing, he was spending on behalf of MERS and the company and the dance company. The music critic Mark Swed out in California, he was in New York in the 80s at the same time I was there. We knew each other in LA, oddly, but we got closer when we were both in New York at the same time, but he's back in LA now. He started to write a book on Cage. I'm not sure he'll ever finish it, but he started one back then and doing research at Northwestern, which is where the correspondence collection is. And he came back very excited one day in New York when we were all living there that he has been spending a lot of time at Northwestern. And he said he couldn't believe how many letters there were there from Cage to and from people having to do with the subject of raising money for MERS. And then he expanded his search. And then it was not just MERS, it was for other people writing for on behalf of your wanting a Guggenheim, writing a fundraising letter for the American Music Center, all these different kinds of ways of helping other people. And Mark thought that would be a marvelous book of just the generous Cage. He never did that. And I'm not sure that anybody wants to spend their time doing that, but it's a nice idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like another way of changing the world. Anyway. Yeah. You told me once before, and I think you should talk about it now, is that you didn't come to the printed form of the Radio Happening.
Correct. I came to the Radio Happenings when you sent me, as a text, when you sent me this book about a month or 6 weeks ago. I always had listened to them, and I still do. I love listening to them while I'm working. I keep finding new things, or I don't know if I would say find new things. I pick up on new things. The last time I listened to them, I was really struck by both Feldman and Cage's discussion and sense of not wanting their work to be fixed. The idea that once the work is fixed, once it becomes, I think they even refer to it as an object, that it dies. There's a great moment where Cage says that, because they'd both been traveling in Britain before they had this particular conversation. And Cage sort of came away from that visit saying that the British Empire was Britain's winter, you know, that nothing was growing. When many people would say it was at the apex of its power and achievement, you know, to Cage, it was dead. And and he saw the post-empire as spring, as a chance to reemerge. Now, this was the mid-1960s, which perhaps felt like spring in many ways and in many places. But yeah, so I love listening to them because you come across things that, you know, I've listened to them hundreds of times and I hadn't really paid attention to that particular thing before.
Interesting. I've had the same experience. I haven't, not that I listened to them all that much. I transcribed them and then off they went away. But in rereading them in anticipation of talking with you more specifically about them, I started to, you know, put little stickums or pieces of paper on pages. And I can't tell you how thick it got. The book got really thick because so many of the ideas, I wanted to hang on to them. I wanted to remember those ideas, you know?
Yeah. Which ones stand out?
Oh God, I would have to pull the book out again. Right. It's just more this kind of overall thing that Cage was a, I don't even know what to call him, a helper. He was somebody who took everything seriously, that he never dismissed a friend, never. He would always listen to you and be constructive in whatever he said back to you. And it's more that throughout the book. And sometimes it's remarkably refreshing what he says. Going back to like the idea of an intrusion, even that. And he put his money where his mouth was always because the business of the intrusion, he answered the phone. Now, was the phone ever an intrusion? You bet. You know, we'd be in the middle of oh, I don't know, he maybe would be interviewed. And the phone would ring. And I said, you want me to turn it off? No, 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 no. So he would be interrupted.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't one say, I'm curious what you think about this, that the music is full of intrusions, actually. You know, you don't get comfortable in much of Cage's music. You know, one hones in on something. I think of the Your Operas, for instance, that you and I saw together in Los Angeles. You know, one never quite knows what's coming next, where it's coming from. And it seems to me that as the radio story he tells in First Radio Happening suggests, he really embraced intrusion.
Remember, there's a whole section, I want to say it's in the very first part of the book, where it's on the subject of the radios. And he says, Morty, I know how magnificent you are as a deep thinker. I want to see how you are when you're interrupted.
Yes,
how magnificent can you be? Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's not like he said, oh, buck up, Morty, you know, get over yourself. He's saying, I want to see what you do with that.
Yes. There's another lovely bit where he asks Feldman if he would like to have his door open or closed.
Oh, yeah.
And Feldman says, well, I'd like to have it left open, but I don't want to be disturbed.
Exactly. He says he wants it both ways. And Cage says, aha, you know. But even then, he doesn't say anything or lead you to think that he's having any bad feelings about Feldman's answer.
He's interested
in Feldman's answer of wanting it to be both ways. He wants the door open, but he doesn't want to be disturbed by what he might hear with the door open.
Yeah. You know, one thing I do think that one doesn't get from reading the text, that you do get from listening to the actual conversations, there's long silences where they're thinking. You hear them striking matches to light.
They were both chain smokers in the 60s. Exactly.
And the laughter as well. Even though when you transcribed it, you say either one of them laughed or both of them laughed. And that's great. One needs that, I think. But to actually hear it and to, as you said at the beginning, you really get a sense of how much they're enjoying each other. And I also thought I had not even known about till I read the book was the postscript at the very end, because it's this little brief conversation after the happening is actually finished. And you do get a sense of their awareness of the conversation as performance. At least that was my sense of that.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And whether or not they had a conversation about that beforehand is unknown. You know, did they? It'd be fun to have Cage and Morty back just to ask these questions. You know, when you decided, yes, let's do this, let's do a number of shows. It's just 6 months. You know, they just did these shows for a period of 6 months and that was it. Did they make that decision ahead of time? Let's do a finite number and let's entertain the audience. You know what I mean? I have no idea.
Yeah.
I think it just stemmed out of, I can only assume that it stemmed out of their enjoyment of talking.
Right. Mm. Yes. Their little interactions about Stockhausen are really interesting too. And Morty Feldman, he's sort of irritated by Stockhausen, but also it seems impressed a little bit by him, or more than a little bit. And Cage is a little irritated because he's requested a score for his book, Notations, and Stockhausen is at that time, I think he did get one in the end, but I think he did. I think he said in the conversation that, or maybe it's a footnote actually. I think
that in the end it happened. Yeah.
But he did get one. There's this great little bit where he says he sent a notogram to Stockhausen.
Uh-huh. Right.
And you know, I had no idea what a notogram was, you know.
Do you know now?
Well, he explains it. I think
because I'll bring you one. We have boxes of them. You can have a John Cage, an empty one. You can have, you know, the carbon and the three colors and the,
I would love to have one.
I always try to find a gift for a guest that's appropriate to that person. You're going to get a notogram.
Okay. Thank you.
You just made me think of something else, though. Oh, going back to Stockhausen. Do you remember Cage saying that it's a conversation about Black Mountain College and how people wanted to bring back Black Mountain College and yes. Cage really being of the mind that Black Mountain College was only possible with the personality of Joseph Albers, that yes. it needed someone who was Germanic and then could let go. And that was a lovely quality of Albers. He could get you to order, but then he could release you too. So that's the only thing that kept Black Mountain going. And he says, who would we get now? And he says, maybe Stockhausen, you know, and he likens Stockhausen a little bit to both Schoenberg and Albers, as I recall, which I thought was really interesting.
Yes, that's a great bit about Albers. And that made me think of Cage's thing, which I forget where I found this or where it is. But he said, permission granted, but not to do whatever you want.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Cage used to say, how do I give people freedom without letting them or endorsing or they feel license to be foolish? It troubled him a lot.
Yeah. Well, that sounds as if that notion was really what he was saying about Albers, that there was this structure right. within which people had a great deal of freedom.
Right. And that it was unique to have that. It's terrible to say, but our time is up. See, I told you it goes really fast.
Oh.
But this is so we can play a lot of the radio happenings, which would be just a yes. pleasure, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely.
I think I'm going to put some in the beginning and in the end, as I said.
Such a pleasure to listen to.
I agree.
On one of your long drives between New York and...
And Maryland these days. It's true. And I'll probably say this, but it bears repeating that the Music Text book that came out in 2015 is a collaboration with Mode Records. And it has a beautiful CD, especially a DVD for its size, of all of the radio happenings in audio form. So for the likes of Richard Kraft, you get both. So you won't have to decide one or the other. Thank you, Richard. Thank you,
Laura, for having me. Pleasure, as always.
Now on to a bit more of Radio Happening number one.
I think, well, they're just playing my piece.
That might help me next weekend.
Yeah, and I listen to it with pleasure. By pleasure, I mean I notice what happens. I can attend to it rather than, as you say, surrender. I can rather pay attention and become interested in the, what it actually is that you're interested in is what superimposes what happens at the same time, together with what happens before and what happens after.
Yes, but I can't think unless thought is something of the past. The other night I met some friends in a place which I was very nostalgic about. I used to go there and talk a lot. No one could hear each other.
Because of this?
Because of this.
Yeah. Well, this brings up the remark of Satie's that what we need is a music which will not interrupt the noises of the environment. Hmm? In other words, we might then need thoughts which would not impose upon the transistorized radios. All I'm trying to say is that this is a coin which has two sides, and that the... say you think of your thoughts as the reality, or your conversation at least, that you wish to have as a reality, and the environment is an intrusion, then that Satie remark just takes that coin, turns it over, and says the reality is the environment. What you want to do in it is an intrusion. And finally, the work of an artist, for instance, is it not an incisive intrusion? Because for heaven's sake, it didn't exist until the artist does it.
Yes, I never heard anybody really boo a transistor radio.
I think, well, you have just now, in a sense, and I have done it formerly when I would go into any friend's home out of deference, you know, to my tastes. Seeing me coming, they simply turned off all the any radio that was, or even a disc that happened to be playing at the time. Now they no longer do it. They know that I think that I composed all those things.
Well, it's a problem for me. I feel that I'm quite at odds with it. Well, I really like things to, but for example, if I'm standing in front of a jet and I hear the blaring sound, I don't feel annoyed because I know it's going to take me someplace.
Yeah. Or that it's bringing some friend.
The noise is utilitarian. And it almost dramatizes the flight, you know.
Yeah. But that then is not an intrusion, really. That's a sound which, because of other things you're doing, you must carry along, as it were, with you, with your experience at any rate. What would you say to giving a concert of your works in an architectural situation where something else that was going on was at least partly audible at the same time? Let's imagine, just to make the conversation consistent, that the concert is in a room and that one door from that room is open, and in the room upon which it opens, radio music is audible. Now, must that door be closed, or may it be left open?
I would like the door to be left open, but without the radio. You see, I want to leave the door open, but of course...
Well, all we have to do to know that in that room, if the door is open, all we have to do to know that there is something in that room that if we are exercising our choices, we will know that in that room is something we don't desire, if we are living with our desires or our choices. And the only thing, that the simplest thing you can do to find out that that's the case is simply to pick up a newspaper, because the things that are happening are not things that you would have chosen in your right mind to have happen in the world, in that room.
Now, years ago, the radio was blaring. I think that there was just as many intrusions as there are today, but I didn't hear them. Today I hear them. So there must be something there that seems to be competing with me. Or let's put it this way, that my old role has been weakened psychologically.
Well, what was your role?
The old-fashioned role of the artist, deep in thought.
Well, this is certainly changing, I think. And um, Since it's perfectly clear that you're a magnificent artist in that role of being deep in thought, what I would like to see is how magnificent you are intruded upon. What do you think of that idea? Do you recall, isn't this true that once when we had one of those conversations we so, I'm sure each of us so remembers walking through the streets of Lower East Side and the Village and whatnot until late hours at night. I think I expressed once the idea that you had discovered a world, a musical world, because it was your music really that opened up everything, your piece, what was it called, the one for, I think the first one was for piano.
Projection,
yes. And you wrote it down at Monroe Street, and David Tudor and I were in the other room, and you left us, and you wrote this piece on graph, giving us this freedom of playing in those three ranges, high, middle, and low. And then we went in and played the piece, and it was then that the musical world changed. Now, not just the musical world outside of you, but the musical world inside of you, in this role that you speak of, deep in thought. Nevertheless, the thing I think I said to you once on that walk through the night is, now that you have opened up this world, let us see all the things that are in it. Now, among the things that are in that world, is this situation of, granted someone deep in thought, his being intruded upon.
Yes, but that's become the image. That's become the image.
No, there are many images now, I would say. I think there are... I don't think we can count them any longer.
I mean, for myself, I mean, it's become very the predominant one.
Because
someone who is thinking and always interrupted.
Yes.
In this thinking.
Yes.
Which, of course, is always a marvelous thing, because you begin to see that what you're thinking about isn't that important to begin with.
Yes.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.